Today is Thursday, January 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The United States has a new president.
I, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
Office of President of the United States.
Now, what's in store for the next 4 years?
We face an attack on our democracy and on truth, a raging virus, growing inequity.
That and more next. Democrat Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th U.S. president on Wednesday, taking the helm of a country beset by deep political divides and battered by a raging coronavirus pandemic.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., do solemnly swear.
I, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
Office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help you God. Congratulations, Mr. President.
Biden succeeds Republican Donald Trump, who left the White House early on Wednesday after a tumultuous 4 years in office. During his inaugural address, Biden told a deeply divided country reeling from a battered economy and a raging coronavirus pandemic that has killed more than 400,000 Americans that democracy has prevailed.
America has been tested, and we've come out stronger for it. We will repair our alliances and engage with the world once again, not to meet yesterday's challenges, but today's and tomorrow's challenges. And we'll lead not merely by the example of our power, but by the power of our example.
He called the current challenges facing the country a time of testing.
We face an attack on our democracy and on truth, a raging virus, growing inequity, the sting of systemic racism, a climate in crisis, America's role in the world. Any one of these would be enough to challenge us in profound ways. But the fact is, we face them all at once, presenting this nation with one of the gravest responsibilities we've had. Now we're going to be tested. Are we going to step up, all of us? It's time for boldness, for there's so much to do. And this is certain. I promise you, we will be judged, you and I, by how we resolve these cascading crises of our era. We will rise to the occasion is the question. Will we master this rare and difficult hour? Will we meet our obligations and pass along a new and better world to our children? I believe we must. I'm sure you do as well. I believe we will. And when we do, we'll write the next great chapter in the history of the United States of America, the American story.
Biden pledged to act in the nation's service.
I give you my word. I will always level with you. I will defend the Constitution. I'll defend our democracy. I'll defend America. And I'll give all of you, keep everything I do in your service, thinking not of power, but of possibilities, not of personal interest, but the public good. And together we shall write an American story of hope, not fear, of unity, not division, of light, not darkness, a story of decency and dignity, love and healing, greatness and goodness. May this be the story that guides us, the story that inspires us, and the story that tells ages yet to come that we answered the call of history. We met the moment. Democracy and hope, truth and justice did not die in our watch but thrive. That America secured liberty at home and stood once again as a beacon to the world.
President Biden spent part of his day in the Oval Office signing a series of executive orders.
Some of the executive actions I'm going to be signing today are going to help change the course of the COVID crisis, and we're going to combat climate change in a way that we haven't done so far. and advance racial equity and support other underserved communities. We're going to rebuild our economy as well. And these are just all starting points. We're going to, in the process of rebuilding the economy, do what I said throughout the campaign and while running rebuild the backbone of the country, middle class. And so there's going to be a lot of focus on that. And I think some of the things we're going to be doing are going to be bold and vital. And there's no time to start like today.
These included an immigration bill sent to lawmakers that would open a path to citizenship for millions of immigrants living in the United States unlawfully. Here's Catherine Gibson, our VOA congressional correspondent, with a brief overview of President Biden's first actions as the chief executive.
So President Biden is doing what American presidents recently have really come to do best, which is sign executive orders, which somewhat take the place of the work the U.S. Congress should be doing to pass legislation. In this very partisan atmosphere where sometimes lawmakers can't reach agreement on things, the president has increasingly stepped in to make these big decisions. And boy, Biden is really making some of those big decisions in his first day as president. We have everything from a reversal of the travel ban that President Trump instituted in some of his first days in office to a slew of orders that are hoping to combat the coronavirus pandemic here in the U.S., to the U.S. rejoining the Paris Climate Accords, which, of course, the Trump administration had withdrawn from. So really some key actions on a number of issues here in the first few hours of Biden's presidency.
You mentioned Biden's focus on the coronavirus pandemic. One of the executive orders is to reverse the Trump administration's withdrawal from the World Health Organization.
That's right. So they're really reversing some of the early decisions that the Trump administration took in combating the pandemic, not only rejoining the World Health Organization, but also instituting a 100-day masking challenge, which means that everyone on federal property has to wear a mask, and also putting in new coronavirus directors who can really coordinate the administration's response to the pandemic. So a number of actions on that front.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman was in the press radio pool for the final 2 days of the Trump presidency. He shared his observations with me about President Trump's last day at the White House and his trip to his resort at Mar-a-Lago in Florida, where the now former executive resumed civilian life.
So the president came in to Joint Base Andrews in Maryland. It's less than a 15-minute flight from the White House, and this was his last flight as president, of course, on Marine One. Now, the White House had sent out invitations to people, including former staffers who are no longer allies of Trump, inviting them to come out for this, and also asking them to bring along as many as five other people. Well, they got about 200 people out there for this ceremony, and there was a 21-gun salute right after a military band played Hail to the Chief. And then Trump spoke for about 9.5 minutes to this crowd. It was a much more subdued, casual Trump than I have seen really before at a rally-type event. He gave a condensed version of his stump speech that we had seen during these Make America Great Again rallies that he had hoped would win him re-election last year.
I will always fight for you. I will be watching. I will be listening. And I will tell you that the future of this country has never been better.
Now, he did not mention Joe Biden by name, but with the then still First Lady Melania Trump at his side, he said, "I wish the new administration great luck and great success. I think they'll have great success." Those were the most kindest words that we've heard Trump refer to now the new administration up until that point. What was also interesting, Steve, right when he was concluding his remarks, which were obviously pretty ad-lib at this point, he promised to be back in some form. He then told the cheering crowd, "Have a good life. We will see you soon." And then he turned around, with Melania Trump and headed to board Air Force One.
And speaking of Air Force One, you flew with the then president down to Mar-a-Lago. What was the trip like?
Well, as we were coming into Florida, Air Force One descended in altitude right when we were off the coast for the family of the then still president to get a close-up aerial look at the Mar-a-Lago estate where they would be heading. So that was a bit unusual. I can also tell you that it was a much more casual flight than we're used to. The president did not come back to the cabin to talk to the media, either on the record or off the record. We did have an opportunity, thanks to a very friendly steward on the plane, to collect the autographed M&Ms of the president, as well as matchbooks of Air Force One that are very treasured gifts from anyone who has flown on the plane.
And then once in Florida, the president then made his way out to Mar-a-Lago. What can you tell us about the drive from the airport to the location where the president is now resuming his civilian life?
Yes, this was also a very unusual motorcade, which has been quite routine from Palm Beach International Airport to Mar-a-Lago during these years of the Trump presidency. This time around, the motorcade slowed at almost to a turtle's pace as the president admired hundreds and hundreds of supporters who were waving banners and cheering his name, and some of those banners urging him to run again in 2024. It was an overwhelmingly pro-Trump crowd. There were some anti-Trump and pro-Biden signs along the route, which was also very heavily guarded by police. But it did allow Trump, in the waning moments of his presidency, to really take in this atmosphere of adulation that he has been used to seeing when he's been traveling back home to Florida and frankly all over the country and at these rallies during the past 4 years.
You know, speaking about the pro-Trump crowd that was gathered around Mar-a-Lago and along the route, you know, you've been out that way several times on your reporting trips. Was the size of the crowd, the makeup of the crowd, similar to what you'd seen in the past?
No, it was much larger, Steve, than we're used to seeing. There are always some supporters of the president lining the route. That's also true when he traveled around the country as well. But obviously people knew that this was the end of the Trump presidency, and they really wanted to be out there during the last minutes of it to let him know what they thought of him. Now, of course, that crowd, despite what the president might want to think, does not reflect the attitudes towards him nationwide. In a Gallup poll released this week, Trump was departing with a 34% approval rating. That's the low point of his presidency, and it's the weakest average favorability rating of any of his predecessors since the survey began in the 1940s. But I think what's also important to note is that he remains very popular among Republican voters with an 82% approval rating. And that makes him the front runner in 2024, should he choose to run again. And that is something that we know he has been considering. But he's also been telling people, well, I'll be 4 years older then. So maybe he realizes that it's not something that is overly viable, but might depend on his health, among other things.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House Bureau Chief, speaking to us from Pebble Beach International Airport in Florida.
My pleasure, Steve.
China said on Wednesday it wants to cooperate with President Joe Biden's new U.S. administration. This while announcing sanctions against former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and 27 other top officials under President Donald Trump. Other official sanctions include Trade Chief Peter Navarro, National Security Advisors Robert O'Brien and John Bolton, Health Secretary Alex Azar, UN Ambassador Kelly Craft, and former top Trump aide Steve Bannon. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. After 4 years of hostility between the U.S. president and much of the news media, press advocates are hoping for a reset. VOA Press Freedom editor Jessica Jarrett has more.
U.S. journalists are working in an increasingly hostile environment, facing physical attacks and verbal assault from protesters and law enforcement, not to mention relentless verbal attacks by outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump. The pro-Trump mob that assaulted the U.S. Capitol smashed equipment of an Associated Press crew. They charged and yelled epithets at journalists, assaulted crews, and scrawled "Murder the Media" on the building's doors. Over the past 4 years, pipe bombs were sent to CNN. A gunman killed 5 people in the Capital Gazette newsroom in Annapolis, and the government spied on journalists covering the migrant caravans at the southwest border. Angela Graylin Keene, president of the National Press Club Journalism Institute.
It wasn't simply a matter of the president and his aides not liking coverage, which is normal, but they attacked true things in ways that were dangerous and pose physical threats to journalists.
Oh, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people.
And to anybody that would ask a nasty question when you report fake news, which CNN does a lot, you are the enemy of the people.
Trump and his supporters accused the media of treating him harshly and unfairly.
Coverage of any president, really any leader, is by definition not going to, most of the time, be complimentary. That's not usually what makes news. So the scrutiny that Donald Trump got is true. Of course, there was a lot of scrutiny, but that is the job of the press.
Critics say U.S. support for press freedom has diminished on the international stage, where America has historically been a leader. One example is its widely criticized response to the killing of Washington Post correspondent Jamil Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia's Istanbul consulate. Suzanne Nossel of the human rights and free speech group PEN America spoke with VOA by phone.
In the case of Jamal Khashoggi, you know, they made quite clear that they were not going to let this butchering of a journalist interfere with their relationship with the Saudi government.
She says organizations like hers lose leverage to free jailed journalists without support from the U.S. government and its bilateral relations around the world. The State Department has applauded the courage and determination of independent media, and in statements condemned politically motivated persecutions, impunity and attacks, and the threats leveled at female journalists. The White House also had some success, including ongoing efforts to free Austin Tice, an American freelancer missing in Syria since 2012. Incoming President Joe Biden says he will defend the rights of activists and journalists and work to restore relations with the media. But analysts say his press freedom record is less than ideal. The Obama-Biden administration saw tighter access to information, prosecution of sources, and seized journalists' phone records. Suzanne Nossel, CEO of PEN America.
Those were very, very dangerous things and things that we weren't used to seeing in the U.S. either. And those happened during the Obama-Biden administration. So definitely those of us who advocate for press freedom and access to information are watching warily for what will happen during the Biden-Harris administration.
Advocates are pressing for toned-down rhetoric, more protections for media covering protests and unrest, and for the U.S. to stand up for press freedom. Again, Suzanne Nossel, CEO of PEN America.
The Biden administration needs to start speaking out on behalf of individual journalists around the world who are targeted.
As the U.S. enters a new presidency, journalists and rights groups will be pushing for press freedom to be a priority. Jessica Jarrett, VOA News.
Michael Pack, who served as the Trump administration's appointee as CEO of the U.S. Agency for Global Media, the parent organization of Voice of America, notified staff on Wednesday afternoon that he had submitted his resignation at the request of the Biden administration. In Pack's message to employees, he said that he would continue to admire and praise U.S. AGM's journalists and would continue to support the agency as a private citizen. Pack had been a controversial head of the agency during his 8-month tenure. United Nations agencies are warning that more than 350 million people in the Asia-Pacific region are going hungry as the coronavirus pandemic destroys jobs and pushes food prices higher. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The agencies say the pandemic is making it difficult for 1.9 billion people to afford healthy diets, with nearly 690 million globally undernourished. The largest share is in southern Asian countries like Afghanistan. The experts estimate an additional 440 million people are likely to have fallen into extreme poverty in 2020 due to the impact of the virus and lockdowns. Disruption and job losses are preventing families from getting enough to eat in many places. That's evident in the long lines seen at food banks, even in the US. I'm Charles Tuladesma.
At least two people died and several more were injured when a building in central Madrid belonging to the Catholic Church collapsed Wednesday. Reuters' Lauren Anthony has more.
Initial investigations suggested the blast in Calle de Toledo, a street that leads out from the city center, had been caused by a gas leak, according to the city's mayor, José Luis Martínez Almeida. Smoke billowed out of the collapsed building and rescue workers evacuated elderly people from a nearby nursing home. The top five floors were totally destroyed with walls blown out, while the bottom two floors were still mostly intact, but charred in places from the flames. A church official said one volunteer was missing. A neighbour said the building was a complex that provided residential training for priests and also gave meals to homeless people.
Lauren Anthony reports for Reuters News. Turkey has often been described as the gateway between Asia and Europe, and because of its location, millions of refugees have arrived in the country as a way station in their effort to migrate to Europe. VOA's Bejan Hamdar narrates this report on how Afghan refugees are struggling to survive in Istanbul.
More than 450,000 migrants entered Turkey illegally in 2019, according to the country's Directorate of Migration Statistics, a huge increase from 2013. Most of the undocumented migrants over the past 3 years came from Afghanistan. Among them, Bashir Nazari.
It's difficult to live in Afghanistan. At least we have food to eat here. We are happy in Turkey so far. There's no government in Afghanistan. If Afghanistan had a government, we would not be suffering like this.
Some 47,000 Afghan migrants live in Turkey as of December 2020, according to migration statistics. Many go through hardship and danger trying to reach the country.
It was very difficult for us to come here from Afghanistan. We had to go through Iran with no documents. On the way, most immigrants get stopped by thieves. We had to pay $500 to $600 to continue our route. We risked dying to come here, to work for our parents and family, and to survive.
I came here on foot, crossed Pakistan and Iran. In Afghanistan, there's war. There is no state, no money.
Once in Turkey, finding work is another difficult challenge. Being undocumented, Afghan migrants are limited to only working as day laborers at jobs such as painting, landscaping, or construction. Most say the pay is low and the work hard.
Because there is a war in Afghanistan, we cannot work there. It is also difficult to live here in Turkey. We need money to pay the bills for the water, electricity, gas, rent. And we can't find jobs in winter. There are not too many job opportunities for us here.
For the thousands of undocumented migrants in Turkey, their hope is to have their status legalized with proper work documentation or to find a pathway to Europe. For Hilmi Hacıoğlu and Umut Çolak in Istanbul, Turkey, Bejan Hamdan, VOA News.
The European Space Agency previews a big 2021, starting with a new boss. Data shows last year's temperatures tied the hottest on record, and French wines returned to Earth after a year aboard the International Space Station. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has those stories.
Aboard this SpaceX Dragon capsule, seen here undocking from the International Space Station this week, rides precious, precious cargo. 12 bottles of Bordeaux and hundreds of snippets of vines from Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon varieties spent the past year in outer space. A Luxembourg startup sent the grape-based experiments to space for research. The company says it plans to open a bottle or two in February for an out-of-this-world wine tasting. Meanwhile, scientists from the European Space Agency here working on the latest version of the Vega rocket system are preparing for a busy year. First, the agency named Austrian scientist Josef Aschbacher as its new director to begin work in June. The ESA also plans to send two astronauts to the ISS and begin recruitment efforts for a new team of astronauts. Europe's space agency will continue its work with NASA on the Artemis mission, which aims to land the first woman and next man on the moon by 2024. Deeper in space, the ESA has plans to retrieve Martian samples in 2022, fly by Venus in August, head to Mercury, and also to study the sun's polar regions. Finally this week, another warning from climatologists about rising temperatures on Earth.
Heat waves are observably more frequent in many parts of the world already, whereas with precipitation, there's much less certainty in terms of average precipitation.
Freya von Borg is a top scientist at the EU's Copernicus Climate Change Service. Their recent findings show that 2020 tied 2016 as the warmest year ever recorded.
When we look at just one year in isolation, of course, that year in itself is not a marker of climate change. But of course, without this trend, temperatures wouldn't have been as warm as they were in 2020, nor would they have been as they were in 2019 and the past years.
Von Borg says the trend shows the past 6 years as being the hottest on record. And despite the drop in carbon emissions caused by coronavirus-related slowdowns in human activity, temperatures remain on the rise. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day by visiting our website, voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a tremendous Thursday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned over Vietnam's conviction and sentencing of three members of the Independent Journalists Association of Vietnam. The association is a civil society organization that advocates for press freedom. On January 5th, the People's Court in Ho Chi Minh City sentenced the association's founder and head, Pham Chi Dong, to 15 years in prison. His deputy, Nguyen Thuong Thuy, and journalist Luu Minh Tuyen were each given an 11-year sentence. The men were convicted under an anti-state provision that bans the production and dissemination of so-called distorted information about the people's government. In a statement, U.S. State Department Principal Deputy Spokesperson Cale Brown called the sentences harsh and said that they are the latest in a troubling and accelerating trend of arrests and convictions of Vietnamese citizens exercising rights enshrined in Vietnam's constitution. Human rights organizations are also outraged. Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director, Emmerlyn Gill, wrote, "Even by its own deeply repressive standards, the severity of the sentences show the depths being reached by Vietnam censors." Reporters Without Borders, or RSF, stated that the sentences of the three Vietnamese journalists were shocking and clearly designed to extinguish any form of civil society debate. Vietnam is ranked 175th out of 180 countries in RSF's 2020 World Press Freedom Index. The U.S. State Department, in its most recent human rights report, said that among significant human rights abuses in Vietnam were the worst forms of restrictions on free expression, the press, and the Internet, including arbitrary arrest and prosecution of government critics, censorship, site-blocking, and criminal libel laws. U.S. Principal Deputy Spokesperson Brown noted, "Press freedom is fundamental to transparency and accountable governance. Authors, bloggers, and journalists often do their work at great risk, and we urge governments and citizens worldwide to ensure their protection." The United States, he declared, calls on the Vietnamese authorities to release all those unjustly detained and to allow all individuals in Vietnam to express their views freely without fear of retaliation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.